listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events in Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, coming to us from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, bring us up to date.
Well, we haven't spoken for a couple of weeks now, Don, so there's a lot to catch up on.
For sure.
We can look at stuff with a close focus and look at stuff from a focus a bit further away.
Yeah.
One of the things that taking a more regional focus is to over the next couple of days there's a very important CARICOM meeting, the group of Caribbean countries, their economic and political framework, CARICOM. And that's taking context, obviously, in a very difficult, wider regional context, with the United States putting a lot of pressure on Venezuela and right-wing governments and right-wing political forces throughout the region making a strong offensive together with their U.S. and European allies to try and consolidate the control and grip that they've been able to build up over the last couple of years in the region.
Right.
So the CARICOM meeting is quite important in that context, because the CARICOM block of countries are the countries that have been mainly responsible for blocking United States' attempts in the Organization of American States to apply OAS sanctions, Organization of American States sanctions, against Venezuela.
Elsewhere, also in other regional groupings too, the CARICOM group has been very protective of the ALBA grouping, basically.
Yeah, and more particularly of the Petro-Caribe Agreement, which was started by, it was the brainchild of Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez back in 2004. Mm-hmm. The Petro-Caribe Initiative is an initiative originally designed to help countries at a time of very volatile oil prices have some stability in their energy supplies. And a couple of years ago, and I'm not sure how if one or two countries have blocked out, have dropped out, but the bloc had a total of something like 19 countries across Central America and the Caribbean of all political shades. It won because it wasn't designed to try and strengthen political allies. It was designed as a development cooperation initiative. Right. To benefit the whole Central American and Caribbean region.
Right. This was one of those things that we've discussed where, regardless of the political inclinations of these right-wing governments, for example, the benefits to the member countries, to the participants, were so strong and so material that they'd be hard-pressed to explain to their own constituents why they're not participating. When you have something like, for example, well, you have to buy oil from somebody. If you buy it here, when you go to pay it back, you can spend half of the money on yourself instead of sending it to the oil company. It's hard to turn that kind of stuff down.
Yeah, they were very favorable terms. It was the people had to pay 50% of the price of the oil they received, I think, within 90 days.
Right.
And the other 50% they could repay over 25 years.
Right.
At 2% interest.
Right.
Where in the world are you going to get favorable terms like that? But one of the there was a kind of conditionality, namely that in order to benefit from that deal, that concessionary deal, the governments concerned had to commit to using the 50% that they had to pay back over a long time for social investments and investment in agricultural credit and stuff like that.
Local development. In other words, if you invest this in yourself instead of sending it to us to help pay off interest or whatever, then that's okay. We'll credit that against the repayment and or enable you to do it on these long-term agreements instead of on a short-term agreement.
Yeah, and that's all. And so that originally it was almost exclusively to do with oil supplies.
Yep.
But as Petrocaribe developed, they realized that they had to pay more attention to things like food security and food sovereignty.
Yep.
And so Petrocaribe, if you read the reports, the internal reports about what Petrocaribe is doing, you'll find working groups on stuff like food security, for example, or climate change and stuff like that. And so that what Petrocaribe takes an integral view of energy needs and how it's related to the rest of the participating countries' economies. So a very important and regional initiative that's come under a lot of pressure recently from visits by people like Rex Tillerson and currently another Secretary of State for Latin America is doing another visit, not to the Caribbean, but to other countries, and that just indicates in the region, I think it's Chile, Peru, and Argentina that he's visiting. And that so this flurry of visits from high-level U.S. State Department officials, including the Secretary of State himself, Rex Tillerson, indicates the level of interest, the new level of interest over the last 12 months that the United States is dedicating now to try and support its right-wing allies in the region and attack what it regards as its enemies.
Right.
And so part of that is to put pressure on the CARICOM countries to drop Petrocaribe.
Right.
And to work with the United States to meet their energy needs.
Right.
Now, they're not going to do that voluntarily because the United States is not offering them anything like the concessionary terms that members of Petrocaribe get from Venezuela.
Right.
Now, far from it. So what's going on behind the bogus benevolent rhetoric that you're getting out of Tillerson and his colleagues in the U.S. State Department is that they'll be putting on a kind of a friendly face without offering anything substantial, and behind the scenes they'll be saying, do what we want or else.
Right. It's barely behind the scenes, by the way. I mean, you had Tillerson in Austin, saying basically, hey, yeah, this Monroe Doctrine is a pretty cool thing, we like it, yeah.
Right.
So that's not subtle.
Yeah, so there's this kind of regional diplomatic Game of Thrones going on, with the United States trying to marshal its allies and put pressure on potential allies to try and get a majority in the OAS in the Organization of American States that will enable it to get some kind of sanctions approved by that body against Venezuela. Now, they had another try at that just a few days ago, last week, in which they called a meeting to discuss the internal situation in Venezuela in complete contravention of the OAS's own rules.
Right.
And Nicaragua, some people had been saying, oh, well, Nicaragua's taking a low profile. Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo they're going to be very careful about how they express themselves on the issue of Venezuela. Well, that was nonsense.
Right.
Because in that meeting, in that essentially illegal meeting called by Luis Almagro and his secretariat, Nicaragua very clearly stated that they rejected the meeting. They regarded it as a completely illegitimate meeting, and they again expressed their 100% solid support for the Venezuelan government, and that was particularly significant because it was on the anniversary of the murder of Augusto C. Sandino, the Nicaragua's national hero, by the Nicaraguan dictator on the orders of the United States ambassador at the time, Arthur Bliss Lang.
Right.
And so the whole thing around Venezuela is beginning to crystallize, and it's very difficult to see how that situation is going to work out over the next 6, 9, 12 months, especially given the fact that the Venezuelan government and the Venezuelan authorities, based on a decision by the country's National Constituent Assembly, which is currently in session, are going to hold elections on, what is the day, April the 22nd?
I believe that's true, yeah.
Yeah, and so there was a move by the Venezuelan authorities to try and get the legislative elections. Also, I think Nicolas Maduro suggested to the electoral authority that they hold the legislative elections at the same time as the presidential elections. And the presidential elections were originally scheduled for December this year, but the National Constituent Assembly brought them forward. And Maduro suggested to the National Electoral Authority that they could do the same with the legislative elections, but the electoral authority turned around and said that they didn't think that was a good idea. And so the only election scheduled for April are the presidential elections. Now, those presidential elections, the main opposition parties, Primera Justicia and Popular Will, they've stated that they're not going to take part in those elections, but almost all the other opposition parties are.
Right.
Now, there are a total of 18 political parties in Venezuela that have contested recent elections, as I understand it. And of those 18, 15 of those political parties are going to take part. So although the main opposition parties, Primera Justicia and Voluntad Popular, have said that they're not going to take part, that doesn't delegitimize the elections, because a very broad range of political opinion is represented by the 15 parties that will be contesting those elections.
Right.
And of course, that situation comes on foot of the recent decision by the Venezuelan opposition to reject an agreement. And I think we discussed this in our last program a couple of weeks ago. The Venezuelan opposition rejected an agreement that they'd given the impression they were on the point of signing.
Right.
They rejected that agreement for a kind of peaceful coexistence with the government of Nicolas Maduro. And what we've seen subsequent to that, outside Venezuela, very hostile moves by Colombia, for example, moving troops to the frontier,
yep.
Supposedly for internal security reasons.
Yep.
Brazil is the internal situation in Brazil is becoming more and more volatile as they get closer to the presidential elections, right, with the threat, the judicial threat that hangs over the most popular candidate.
Right, yeah, right.
By a mile.
Right.
Lula da Silva, he leads the polls by a mile. I mean,
right,
he'd obviously win the elections if he were allowed to stand. But
right.
I suspect that he will, the judicial system will work against him.
Right.
And he will not be able to participate as the candidate.
Now, yeah, this, I mean, that's like they're fixing two in a row, basically. They removed Dilma Rousseff, clearly illegitimately, although it was formally proper. And now the same thing with Lula.
In the Lula case, and the evidence against him has always been completely inadequate in terms of, there was more than reasonable doubt that the charges against him were completely false. But that's become even clearer now that a database has been discovered that was being tampered with by the very people that were accusing Lula. So and it was evidence from that database that led the prosecutor Silvio Moura to build his case against Lula in the first place. So
look at the previous situation. What Dilma was accused of, isn't even an offense.
No.
And yet she was removed from office over it.
Yeah. So we've said this so many times. It doesn't matter what the evidence is. The process, as long as they can give some kind of semblance of legitimacy to the process, the legal process and the administrative process, that's what matters, and that's all that matters to them, the truth of the matter,
right,
even hard evidence.
But
even if there's no evidence, it doesn't matter. But that goes together, Don, with what's happening now, whereby the Michel Temer, the usurper president in Brazil, is militarizing policing in various urban centers. But that looks like, looked at from outside Brazil, I don't know what it looks like from inside Brazil, but what it looks like from looking to someone monitoring the region is that the Brazilian authorities are preparing for
an uprising.
Crackdown around the elections.
Right, yeah, they're preparing for an uprising. I mean, in essence, here's the situation there. You had both Lula's term and then Rousseff's term. Even with the manipulations and just the market problems with commodities, the things that impacted revenues, that caused some problems in the economy there, and the wrecking that accompanies, the ascendance to power of a socialist or even a progressive government. They just start messing with it from the outside. People's situation improved, and their expectation that it would continue to improve became almost institutionalized in a good, substantial sector of the population. And then you had this thing that was done with Rousseff, which clearly looked stinky to anyone looking at it, even if they accepted the legitimacy of it because it was under the forms, under their law, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is terrible, but, at least it's not a general taking over and, et cetera. Now they're doing it again. Accompanying this charade in politics, of course, is the reality setting in that, in fact, your situation is no longer improving and it's going to get worse. And so there's a point in time. I mean, this is what we saw with Sanders and Trump in the United States. You can have the best line of bull possible disseminated over the loudest loudspeaker and plugged into every single brain in the whole population and sell the best fantasy. After a while, you can't tell people they're not hungry if they haven't eaten in 2 weeks or a month. Their body takes over and tells them what to do. And they're going to reach that point in Brazil.
Yeah. Reality goes on existing, as it were, your back.
That's right.
So, it suddenly surprises you. But the other thing to bear in mind about the militarization that Temer is implementing in Brazil is that does have a regional significance in terms of the pressure on Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of last year, there were military exercises involving various countries, including the United States, in Brazil. only 100 kilometers or so from the Venezuelan border. Venezuela has quite a long border with Brazil. It has a 1,200 kilometer border with Colombia. So anything involving militarization in those countries
right.
is implicitly a threat to Venezuela.
Right.
And then if you look at the situation in Colombia, that what you were just talking about how the situation in Brazil is an attempt to control dissent.
Right.
There in Colombia, you have a situation where they have elections, I think towards the end of next month. I've forgotten the exact date of the presidential elections in Colombia. But there are a couple of things going on. The government withdrew from peace talks with the only important remaining guerrilla group in Colombia, the
right.
Ejército de Liberación Nacional.
Right.
It looks as though that they might be back on track, but that's not clear. But what is clear is that the FARC guerrillas who signed the peace agreement in good faith and are now trying to participate as a legitimate political party in Colombia's electoral campaign for the Colombian presidency, they're getting murdered.
Right.
And in general, community leaders and indigenous peoples are being attacked, and the government is doing nothing about it.
Let's be clear here. When you say they're being murdered, we're not talking, this isn't a political term. This isn't symbolically murdered, slaughtered at the polls. This is, they're being murdered, dragged out of the house, shot, disappeared.
And so the, at one point, the FARC stopped campaigning. I don't think they've taken the decision to begin campaigning again because it was just too dangerous for their candidates.
Yes, May 27th is the first round of presidential, and then the 17th of June, the second round, if it's necessary.
Right. So then, and just look at the figures. In January, I think it was around 30 indigenous and community leaders were murdered in Colombia who had not on party political grounds. It was just because they were active in their communities, defending the interests of their communities.
Right.
And then on top of that, you've had the murder, and I'm not showing it of the exact number. I mean, it could be as high as 20 members, ex-members of the FARC, who've also been murdered.
Right.
You know, but none of that gets reported in any serious way in the Western mainstream corporate media.
Right. I mean, that's germane too. Look, what's happening in terms of the way they're fraying the peace agreement is that it favors the continued ability of the paramilitary groups to operate. And so, for example, when you talk about activity at the Venezuelan border, you know, if the government has firm control of everything, then an action taken against Venezuela would be an act of the Colombian state and you know, everything that goes with that. However, if you have a president who's honestly trying to hold together this peace agreement, whether that's what he's doing or not, by the way, because no one can say for sure he has total control of the situation there either.
Right.
But, you know, well, gee, we tried, but, you know, these groups that are loyal to, you know, the former president, they're out of our control, and it was one of them probably that you know, snuck in and killed 11 Venezuelan security people or whatever. You know, so you got this game going on where there's instability on both sides that will allow not just military action within those countries, but also against Venezuela since they both border it.
Yeah, and the United States is very, very clearly putting pressure on Juan Manuel Santos
right.
to take a hard line against Venezuela. So then, if you look at all that stuff in the regional context, and there's that going on, it's very clear that the United States and its right-wing allies are trying to consolidate their position. Today, that subsecretary of state from the U.S. State Department is visiting. He has a meeting with Lenin Moreno in Ecuador.
Yeah.
And so there again, we're almost certain to see some kind of announcement over the next few days in which Ecuador's foreign policy position is likely to shift, probably only very slightly.
Right.
But over time, I have no doubt at all that Ecuador will probably leave ALBA.
Yeah, we know where it's going. I mean, they'll start with, we completely support Venezuela so long as she continues on her current path to seek reconciliation. And that's going to morph into, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's too bad that the revolution was betrayed by Maduro, and now let's get him. that's where they're going with this guy.
That might well be the way the official propaganda line goes.
Right.
But in fact, for Lenin Moreno, he's in a very difficult situation because he made a deal with the devil, the devil being the Ecuadorian right wing.
Right.
And that means that he's lost a lot of support. And although he won his referendum that he held a few weeks ago, which was essentially a referendum based on initiatives in favor of Ecuador's ruling business classes.
Right.
But that Rafael Correa's bloc, despite all the disadvantages that they suffered, still got 36% of the vote,
right,
which makes them, it may be a mistake to think of that 36% as solid support for Correa,
right,
but it's certainly a bloc of opinion, the biggest bloc of opinion in Ecuador.
I think the deal with the devil that Moreno made, from his point of view, I don't think is the deal he made with the right. It's becoming clear that he actually is of the right. And so the deal with the devil he made was playing the game that he did in order to get the vote that belonged to Correa. So, in other words, he told the Ecuadorian people, this is what I'm going to do for you, and now he's going to not do it. And these people are used to getting that stuff delivered when it's promised.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's his deal with the devil problem is going to be there. And like, oh, I shouldn't have got into power this way because these people are going to hold me accountable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, and we've only got a few minutes left on, and there's so much else we should look. And looking at that in a regional context, what you were talking about earlier about reality, people waking up to reality and realizing that the electoral promises that were made to them were complete nonsense, as if there's anything new in that.
Yeah, right.
But you can see that very clearly in Argentina. I mean, you can see it very clearly in Honduras, of course, where the opposition continues to protest.
Yeah. Well, in Honduras, and you know, the people in Honduras know that the government's illegitimate because they had to actually remove them from office in the one hand, and the other hand, you know, block the guy's access to the front door of the presidential palace by theft. So nobody's fooling them. No, the people in Honduras know. Nobody's fooling them.
Yeah, I think that to some extent they are deluding themselves when they kind of appeal to the international community.
Well, what can you do though? I mean,
or they think that they're going to get some result out of the Organization of American States, which has played a very cynical, hypocritical double game in Honduras.
Well, I'm glad you went there because I wanted real quick. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you today, but this one thing I want to get across when we're talking about the OAS. And talking about interfering, Article 19 says no state or group of states has the right to intervene directly or indirectly for any reason whatsoever in the internal or external affairs of any other state, period.
Right.
And it says not only armed force, any other form of interference or attempted threat against the state, the personality, its political, economic, and cultural elements. In other words, stay the hell out of each other's business.
Right. And of course, the United States has never...
Right. They've been using it as an instrument to do exactly that. I mean, that's the enabling purpose of this group for the United States. It is itself an intervention in the affairs of all of the other states in the West.
Sure. So there's all that going on, but one shouldn't take the view that the United States and its right-wing regional allies have it all their own way. So, for example, in Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he's well ahead in the opinion polls, not to the same extent as Lula in Brazil, but sufficiently well ahead to make it look as though he stands a good chance, finally, of defeating the Mexico's corrupt electoral system. We won't know until July.
Right.
But he will be a very difficult... if he makes it to the presidency, he'll be a very difficult person for the United States to co-opt. And then you have political leaders like López Obrador, like Lula, like Manuel Zelaya and Salvador Nasralli in Honduras, who are very prominent and well able to project an opposition point of view that contradicts the U.S. propaganda line.
Right.
Then in Argentina and Brazil and elsewhere, you have very widespread public protests against the failed neoliberal policies.
Right.
As far as they're concerned, as far as the poor majority is concerned, they're failed policies. Of course, as you constantly point out, they're not failed policies from the point of view of the elite.
Right.
But so then, and then you also have what we've talked about in the past, on many occasions, the contradictions at a very high level in economic and trade terms between the regional governments and the need for them to develop their trade and economic relations with China in particular, but with Asia in general, and how that contradicts the wishes of the United States. So that also generates very difficult contradictions. And for example, even though Sebastian Piñera is going to assume the presidency in Chile very soon, his predecessor Michelle Bachelet has just finished a tour of Asia. And in Japan, she had some very important meetings in Japan.
Yep.
So,
yeah, there's a lot of foot.
Not just China.
That's right. There's a whole, well, look at Nicaragua, for example, has excellent trade relations with Taiwan, which seems like a complete contradiction, but it's a fact. We got to stop here because we're out of time. And when we pick it up next week, I'd like to maybe start here, and because also it'd be a very interesting dynamic to have this outsider come to the presidency in Mexico, given the dynamics with the United States with Trump.
Yeah,
it'd be an opportunity
absolutely.
For Trump. So. Okay, we got to stop there, and I will be back with you as soon as we can manage that, and I appreciate your time as always.
Okay, look forward to it, Don.
Yep,
take care.
Take care, I'll see you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. From North Korea to Syria, President Donald Trump's foreign policy is literally all over the map. North Korea says it is open to direct talks with Washington, only to be met with preconditions. In Syria, where the U.S. has no legal right to be in the first place, peace is within view. But this is not what the Trump administration wants. Crosstalking Missing Diplomacy, I'm joined by my guest, Earl Rasmussen in Washington. He is the Executive Vice President of the Eurasia Center. In New York, we have Daniel Lazar. He is an author and freelance journalist who writes frequently about the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the U.S. Constitution. And in Fort Lauderdale, we have Ivan Elin. He is a Senior Fellow and Director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, let me go to you first here. We're calling this program Missing Diplomacy. And let's look at two areas where a lot of diplomacy is necessary, North Korea and Syria. In both cases, there have been or still present some kind of diplomatic opening, considering the very fierce rhetoric we've heard about a second phase and when we look at from the Trump administration for North Korea. And then the U.S. Essentially obstructing a number of peace processes and designs in Syria. Where is the diplomacy? Daniel, go ahead.
Diplomacy is absent. We have a very erratic individual at the top, Donald Trump, who has little idea what he's doing. But it's very important to emphasize that the U.S. empire is vastly overextended. It's gotten itself in deep trouble in a number of parts of the world, including Korea and Syria. And so there really is no easy way out. So Trump's confusion is a reflection of the larger confusion of the U.S. system.
Okay, Ivan, that's a point, you know, and we can put it on the person of Donald Trump, but I would put it on the people he surrounded himself with. My impression, and I'm very far away, is that he's basically disinterested in these topics and he's delegated it to others. And unfortunately, a lot of them are neocons. Go ahead, Ivan.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. His campaign pledges were different than his than what he's doing now. His pledges was let's stay out of a lot of stuff, America first. Let's do what we need to do here at home, et cetera, and get in, don't do nation building overseas, et cetera. But I do agree that the U.S. has been overextended for a long period of time, and he's exacerbating the problem. And it is very confusing to him because his advisors do not give him the option of saying, well, you know, we deterred radical Mao Zedong when he got nuclear weapons in China, so he can probably deter Kim Jong-un in North Korea, because dictators, they just want to survive. That's their main goal, is surviving in power. And so, why threaten a paranoid guy, right? But, that's not what they're doing. In Syria, of course, his main objective was to, was to get ISIS. Well, ISIS is at least, vastly shrunk in size of territory. Now, whether they'll come back elsewhere, I don't know. But certainly, if you've done with the job, get out. But of course, the United States is not doing that because it has forces on the ground. It wants to keep control of territory so that it has a role in the Syrian negotiations. That's a much different mission than we started with.
Earl, that's exactly right. And you could apply that, Syria staying there to determine political outcomes, staying in South Korea to determine political outcomes. That is exactly it. And it's a zero-sum game. Either we get what we want or there's going to be trouble. There could be potentially even war. I mean, that's not how you run a foreign policy. Well, if that is foreign policy, it's an extension of military policy. And it precludes or excludes the possibility of peacemaking. You can think whatever you want of the North Korean regime. But if the North Korean regime and South Korea are talking and both want to talk more, and the South wants the U.S. to talk to North Korea, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because the alternative is far, far worse. Go ahead, Earl.
Yeah, I think, Peter, it's unfortunate, but I don't necessarily think people want a direct conflict. However, we're getting dangerously close that one could accidentally happen, especially when we've got erratic leaders in place that want their survival, or they're looking for the political perspective, and they back in their own selves in their corner, and sometimes things happen that you don't expect. But I think when we look at Syria, the U.S. is concerned about the rising role of Iran and Russia in the Middle East, and I think there's pressure from both from the U.S. side, from one of their close allies in the area, as well as some of the Gulf states. They do not want to see Iran raising up. So you see these accusations, they're violating the nuclear accord. You see them trying to, even though they're welcome in Syria, trying to force them to get out of the region. It's a dangerous situation there, and the U.S. really right now appears they just want to stay present there and present in Korea as well to really, I don't know if it's necessary to counter North Korea more than just as much as perhaps to counter the rising influence of China in the region as well.
Of course, that's the whole point, okay? That's why they want to stay there. They want to determine, well, first of all, they want to make sure that if there's a unification of the peninsula, they determine what that unification is, because going right up to China's border would be what the President White House would very much want. And the Chinese don't want that happen. No surprise. Daniel, let me go to you. Earl was mentioning about U.S. presence in Syria and Iran. Well, I mean, it's the activities of the United States in the region since 2003 that has only advanced the interests of Iran. I mean, how many more events do we have to go through? How many more failed regimes do we have to go through in that region to show that the more you push for regime change, the more you push to determine political outcomes, the more you lose? I mean, it's a losing streak, okay, for over a decade and a half, but nobody realizes that. Go ahead, Daniel.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, the U.S. policy in that part of the world has been just amazingly wrongheaded. The invasion of Iraq provided a huge opening to Iran, America's alleged, you know, number one enemy in the region. You said before that, you know, that America wants certain things, you know, in Korea and Syria, but it's not really clear that America even knows what it wants.
Exactly.
Beyond limiting Russian, Iranian, or Chinese influence. But otherwise, it has no idea. It has no positive program. So, you know, and so therefore, the U.S. is trying, you know, is acting at the behest of Saudi Arabia and Israel. Saudi Arabia is maybe falling apart very rapidly. Israel may be facing regime change also as Netanyahu struggles to maintain his grip. So things are crumbling really fast. The U.S. has no idea how to stay on top of these things. And of course, as you say, everything it does seems to make things worse.
Yes, Ivan. You know, it's pushing these pushing for political outcomes. There's an impatience going on right here. I mean, the United States, and I'll just give my opinion, is scared to death that peace could break out on the Korean Peninsula. They're terrified of that. They're terrified that peace could break out in Syria because the very fact that they stay there, where nobody wants them to be there, makes it a political outcome, a peaceful outcome, impossible. I mean, why are they so afraid of peace? Go ahead, Ivan.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. They seem to want to maintain overseas presence in South Korea and Japan. That's where our major forces are right now. And that gives us, you know, an anchor in East Asia. And I think they do feel that China is rising. And, you know, when Saddam invaded Kuwait, that was a way to stay in Saudi Arabia for a long time. And so I think these types of conflicts are useful in a certain sense for the hegemon to stay in whatever region they want to stay in.
Yeah. You know, Earl, if we look at the South Korean Peninsula, let's look at the region. We got Japan, we got South Korea, we got North Korea, we got China, and we got Russia. Those countries can solve this tension on the peninsula all by themselves, but the U.S. will not let that happen. The U.S. will not allow South Korea full sovereignty over its defense planning. And this is the real problem here. I think it could be solved with regional players. Go ahead, Earl.
I would agree. In fact, I made a comment on a blog recently. They were talking about there was some type of conference in Vancouver that Canada was hosting. Of course, the U.S. was there and other players. But two players to discuss the resolution, what direction to go forward on Korea. And of course, the two players that probably should most importantly be there, Russia and China, were not invited. Yeah. And so I think I agree that I think, and I also think the new president in South Korea is open to dialogue with North Korea. I think you saw that during the Olympics, a potential, you know, maybe a slight melting of some ice there. But I do not think the U.S. sees it as in their interest to actually have a dialogue unless it's under their terms. And unfortunately, I think personally, I agree. I think the regional powers there could come to a very good settlement. It could be general for everyone. But the U.S. wants to play the role as far as determining what the conditions are. And I don't think that's very healthy for the future of Korea and for the region. And it's very dangerous under the current environment.
Let me go to Daniel before we go to the break here. One of the things I find very problematic, troubling, is that diplomacy is equated with appeasement these days. That is terrifying. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yes, it is. It's the U.S. is in a very militant mood. It's not interested in diplomacy or talking. Look, the America wants to prolong its unipolar moment, which broke out in 1989. But now it's faced with challenges by China, Iran, and Russia, and it's trying to hold them off, trying very hard. I don't see how that strategy will be successful, but that's what the U.S. is trying to do.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. Gents, I got to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on missing diplomacy. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to New York with Daniel. Daniel, you wanted to finish up your point, the one that you were elaborating on before the break.
Yeah. Yeah, my point simply is the U.S. is trying to fend off a triple threat from Iran, Russia, and China. And there is complete unanimity. I've seen no dissent whatsoever among any of the mainstream commentators or political or politicians, liberal, conservative, or what have you. They all agree that they must rebut the Russian, Chinese, and Iranian threat, menace. And I can't see how that strategy can possibly prevail.
Well, you know, Ivan, I don't agree that there are threats whatsoever. I mean, China is a regional power. Russia is certainly not a global power. Its reach is actually quite small. If you look at Russian foreign policy and defense policy, it's very they're most concerned about their sovereignty more than anything else and the near abroad. I know some people don't like that term, but it's real. Okay, I mean these threats here in Iran, it's surrounded by NATO or NATO-related countries' bases. I mean, this is all a fiction here, but it certainly is very good for the arms industry. I mean, and Donald Trump has been such a sugar daddy to them this year and next year for sure. Go ahead, Ivan.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And we can also add that our South Korean, Japanese and European allies are all very wealthy countries.
Absolutely.
And this is not 1950 anymore. And they can start taking over their own defenses. What about a deal in Korea that says North Korea denuclearizes if the U.S. withdraws all forces from South Korea and South Korea defends itself? You know, we wouldn't have to be immediately over time. That's a possibility, you know, if we're going to do something dramatic. But that's, of course, that's not going to happen. That's wishful thinking because there's a military-industrial complex in many countries, but the one here in the United States, we tend to build up threats larger than they are. And I think your assessment of the various threats was pretty accurate. China may rise, but of course, all the countries in Asia could band together. And they have fairly good internal security. Japan's an island that's very safe. You just have to run a porcupine strategy, et cetera. European allies have more combined economy GDP than the United States does. So, and of course, in the Middle East, it's sort of a canard that we need to defend oil. The market is much better at providing oil at the cheapest prices.
Exactly. You know, Earl, one of the things is, too, is if you look at the client states and the alliances that the United States has created around the globe, these client states do like the status quo for the most part. South Korea in this moment may be a little bit different because they might see it some kind of diplomatic opening and want to take it, and Washington will say no. But like, look at Japan, you know, look at Saudi Arabia, look at Israel. I mean, they're all fat and happy. I mean, the American taxpayer pays for it. They don't even have to be particularly loyal allies. There's a wide avenue of maneuver for them in many cases. And the United States, if you look at, like in the Pacific here, you know, it could easily be pulled into a conflict that it was not of its wanting, but because of all of its alliances here. I mean, all these entangling alliances are very dangerous for the United States, for a country that voted for a man that wanted America first. Go ahead, Earl.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have, 700 bases around the world, basically ringing around, surrounding Iran, surrounding Russia, surrounding China. Absolutely. I mean, essentially, we're providing the military side of the foreign policy for a lot of these countries that are quite well off. And the thing is would peace really and would diplomacy really take hold if we did draw back,
diplomacy
that
would
not be in the interest of
yeah, but diplomacy would have to kick in. It would have to automatically kick in.
Absolutely.
Instead of just saying, Washington said, no, you guys have to sit down and work this out here. I mean, Earl, isn't it remarkable how many borders around the world the United States protects and it doesn't even protect its own border? Go ahead, Earl, finish up.
Yeah, that is interesting. We have more concern over other countries' security than we do our own sometimes. But, there's other political regions in that. There's both lobbying groups on the military side, lobbying groups for other countries that have a significant influence on what's going on. And it's not necessarily for America first, unfortunately. I think it'd be better handled maybe facilitating regional discussions and actual talking to people would be much more beneficial, I think, for global peace. But I don't necessarily think global peace is the major objective. I think it's disruption.
No,
the objective.
Well, it's hegemony is the goal, okay? I mean, that's the goal in Washington. Mm-hmm. You know, Daniel, if True. I could just go astray just a little bit here. You know, I'm sure you've been following the ups and downs and the smoky rooms and mirrors of Russiagate and the 17 hackers in St. Petersburg, which, you know, took about a week of the news cycles. But there's no real concern in the mainstream to talk about the countries that actually really do influence American foreign policy in Washington, D.C. They call it lobbying in the United States here. But, you know, this the kind of influences that Saudi Arabia has, Israel has, Turkey has, Japan, South Korea. We could go all, we could make many, many programs about that. But that's almost kind of a taboo subject to talk about. You can go after Macedonian teenagers fine on Twitter. But, you know, a real serious discussion. I'd like to know how many congressmen and senators meet with foreign lobbyists. They don't have to record it. They don't have to tell anyone. But if you accidentally bumped into the Russian ambassador, well, you get a FISA warrant against you. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, you know, you say you'd like to have some serious discussion. I'd like to have some serious discussion about just about anything in this country.
I agree.
I mean, debate is so debased.
I agree.
It's so it's fallen so far about everything, everything.
Yeah.
So it's farcical, really farcical. But yes, influencing American politics. First of all, politics are internationalized for all countries, number one. Number two, I mean, countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the UAE, Israel, maintain huge lobbies in the United States that are extremely effective. The Gulf states, for example, you know, lavish money. Virtually every major think tank in Washington is funded by the Gulf states. And they use that money to essentially shape and control debates. So in Washington, one rarely gets the opposing non-Saudi, non-Israeli point of view. It's completely outrageous.
Yeah.
And the people who are disturbed by this are the American people.
Exactly.
Who you know, there are very important issues that need to be thrashed out, but which are being, you know, buried and, you know, swept under the rug. It's symptomatic of a political system in deep crisis.
Ivan, you know, there's, and it long ago, there was it was a long time ago when there was public debate about foreign policy. You never hear anything about that. Just as Daniel was saying, I tell people here in American media, don't say much about Israel and don't say anything about Saudi Arabia. Okay? Those are just two examples. Go ahead, Ivan.
Yeah, I think the other participants are right on here. Our whole policy is on autopilot, and what we have is a military that's set up to power project overseas. So we should call the Department of Defense the Department of Offense or the Department of Defense of other countries, because in the few times during our history that the military has been asked to defend the country, it hasn't done it itself. It hasn't done a very good job. In the War of 1812, we got the Capitol burned before they managed to fight the British to a draw after declaring war on the superpower at the time. In World War II, they didn't think the Japanese were capable of attacking Pearl Harbor, so the military failed there. And, of course, on 9/11, the fighter jets went out to sea. So we need to increase our defenses and quit, meddling in other countries' business.
You know, Earl, the thing that I find, again, I think Daniel really hit it here, because I'm very disappointed too, and that's why I have my own program, because I can talk about things that I think are interesting, because when I look at the liberal corporate media, there's almost nothing of interest to me whatsoever. It's tragic stories, it's sad stories, it's political posturing, but there's no debate really about policy, and foreign policy is never, ever debated right now, except for China's bad, Russia's bad, and Iran's bad, okay? That's it. That's all you hear 24/7, and you never hear the other side of the argument. Well, why are they so bad? You hardly ever hear it. Go ahead, Earl.
No, I mean, Daniel's correctly, absolutely correct. I mean, if you look where the funding goes to some of the think tanks that are very influential, where they're coming from, you really don't have a real dialogue on foreign policy. And and it's shoot from the hip sometimes. It's autopilot. It's unfortunate, I think. And even you look at our diplomats, I really, some of the verbiage used in public forums, I'm kind of appalled. Yeah. By, and it doesn't really set a fine example of where we should be as a country, and you know, should be leading into diplomatic efforts, and I really, we're kind of lagging in that area for the most part.
You know, Daniel, you know, well, I know the person that that Earl's talking about. It's talking about Nikki Haley. You know, before she got her job at the UN, the only foreign experience she had was going to the International House of Pancakes. That's what we have in the United Nations. You get the last word, Daniel.
Well, you know, Peter, if I may correct you on one thing, there is some serious debate in this country. For example, a very lively, serious debate has broken out over Jennifer Lawrence's low-cut dress that she wore in a photo shoot for her latest movie, Red Sparrow. And that was a very wide-ranging debate, very serious, touching on a lot of important subjects.
So Daniel, what side of the argument are you on that one there? Go ahead.
No comment. It's much too fraught for me. I would never. I don't have the courage.
Well,
to,
they could.
Just,
you
to
could
step
be.
Into that
you could
one,
be totally destroyed on Facebook and Twitter if you gave your opinion. Okay. God help you. God help us all. All right, gentlemen. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in Fort Lauderdale, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.